I just want to reiterate what everybody said. I really, I personally thoroughly enjoy it when parents and families come to learn with their children. I think, A, it's nice to see parent-child positive interaction, but beyond that, it's nice to see a shared love of learning Torah manifest in a family context. So welcome to the parents. Okay, some of you may have noticed that things are a little different when you come to Israel for Chagim than when you're in America. Right? If you go to your shul in America on Chol HaMoed one morning, you might notice there are different minhagim. There are those that are men that are wearing tefillin, those that are not wearing tefillin. And you might have been curious why they're different minhagim about wearing tefillin in Chol HaMoed. But then, probably a few families have come to Israel for Pesach or Sukkot. They often, like Americans, get a little trapped there. Right? Let's say your minhag is to wear tefillin. So you show up in shul and you have tefillin here in Israel, and all of a sudden you notice you're the only person in shul with tefillin. And people, everyone in shul is giving you dirty looks, in fact. What are you doing with tefillin? So somehow it became the universal minhag in Israel not to wear tefillin in Chol HaMoed. And in America, in Chutz La'aretz, we have varied minhagim. So whenever you have that, you're kind of curious where that all stems from. Why did these different customs come to being? And what are the issues involved? And I think we'll see there's a lot of interesting issues involved. So I guess the first point is, let's start with the days that everyone agrees you don't put on tefillin. Right? If we start with that, that should be a good starting point. Everyone agrees you don't put on tefillin on Shabbat and Yom Tov. Let's begin with that. And then see, should the logic apply to Chol HaMoed? Okay, so let's start with the first source here. Okay, so you have a Gemara in Avon. Rabbi Kiva Omer Yachol Yaniach Adam Tefillin B'Shabbatot V'Yom Tovim. Yachol is always you might think. You might think you should put on tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Talmud Lomar V'Elecha Lo'ot Al Yadcha. It should be an oat. The tefillin is an oat. Mi Shetzrichin Oat. That's only when there's no other oat and tefillin fills the gap. Yatzu Elu Shein Gufanot. But Shabbat and Yom Tov themselves are otot. And apparently once you have the Shabbat and Yom Tov oat, that renders the tefillin oat superfluous. Okay, that's what the Gemara says. That's the original source for not wearing tefillin Shabbat and Yom Tov. So here I have to thank the Markowitz family. They pushed me on this a little bit. So we were curious what mitzvot are called otot in general. So I went to my favorite sefer, the Concordance. And here I have to tell you a good story, so I can hear the story again. Okay, I'm a little bit of a Luddite. Like, I'm kind of pre-technology. I'm still, like, in the 1940s. So I went to try to prove to Shira we don't really need technology. So we did, like, a race. They would use the Bar-Ilan program to look up how often a word appears in Chumash, and I would use it in Concordance. Because I was convinced I would win. Okay, unfortunately, they won. Okay, so I guess we do need technology. But I didn't lose by much, though, I'll say that. The gap is not as big as you might think. Okay, so I was curious how often the word oat appears in Chumash. So I went to the Concordance, and we saw there's several times it appears in narrative. Well, that's not so relevant to us, right? If it appears, let's say, Moshe is going to do an oat in Mitzrayim. Okay, but that's a narrative context, right? There are only three mitzvot where I found it appears. Okay, the only three mitzvot where the Torah says oat are Shabbat, right? Oti b'ni v'nechem, tefillin, ukshartem l'ot al yadcha, and the third is actually Korban Pesach. Although even there, I'm not sure it should really count. Because anyone know which part of Korban Pesach is called an oat? When they put the blood on the doorpost, what could one argue? Yeah, that's unique to Pesach Mitzrayim, not the Korban Pesach for all generations. And in theory, in a sense, that's also more of a narrative context, maybe not the ongoing legal tradition regarding the Korban. So it may very well be that this is true. The only two times in a mitzvah context the Torah used the word oat is Shabbat and Tefillin. Okay, because Maishi asked me correctly, like, couldn't you think of tzitzit as an oat, or I think it's an oat? So conceptually, he's right. I don't have a great answer. But if you just focus on the terminology, right, the two mitzvot are called oat, are Shabbat and Tefillin, and then it's easy to argue that there's some kind of tension or superfluity when those two things intersect. Ben?
Does that imply that the only reason we put on Tefillin is because we need to have an oat?
Okay, Avraham has said yes. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Yeah, Maishi.
We learned Mezuzah from the carbon based off on the wall.
Oh, that's an interesting parallel. Okay, you want to make a parallel? Okay, it's interesting when you okay, this is really a totally other shear, but I'll just mention it very briefly. Yeah, sure. Okay, now Maishi was curious about that imagery of putting blood on the doorpost and on the top in the Mitzrayim context. Does that have an association with something else? So Maishi wanted to associate with Mezuzah. Like, is there some kind of mezuzah, Korban Pesach associated, which is a very fascinating suggestion. That's a good suggestion. I want to make a different suggestion. You got to be careful. Okay? When I get on a good tangent, we might never get back to this year. Okay, but just very briefly, what does that remind you? Okay, besides Maishi's excellent point, I have another association with putting blood somewhere. Here we're putting blood on the doorpost, right, in Pesach. What?
Yosef's coat.
Yosef's coat, not bad. Okay. Any other, I'll make it, what?
Korban.
Excellent. Okay, Shmuel is very good. Okay? In the world of Karbanot, one of the services in Migdash is putting blood on the altar, blood on the Mizbeach. Okay, so several people have suggested, I'm not the first person to suggest this, that some of the imagery there in Mitzrayim is, there's no temple, right? There's no Mishkan, there's no Migdash. So what, as it were, is the holy building, or the holy, the house, like the bayit. Since you have a nice territory now, then now we all know it, right? Right, that the bayit in Egypt becomes the Mizbeach, as it were, or the Mishkan, right? Everyone's house is its own little local holy temple. Right? Maybe that's why the sprinkle of blood takes place on the house. So, Maisha Yipshat's very good, but you have another association. Yeah, please.
So, does the word oath have more than just the simple meaning of a sign?
Look, I admit there's a problem that I am not solving today, which is we probably have to define exactly what an oath is more narrowly and then explain why it's only Shabbat and Tefillin, right? Exactly. Like, why is Tzitzit not a note? Why is Mezuzah not a note? And I admit I don't have a great approach at this point. At this point, I'm just going to hide behind the terminological narrowness. Like, that's where the Torah says it. We're going to go with that for now. I agree. We're going to try to flesh that out. I'm open to good suggestions. Okay, why it's unique to Shabbat and Tefillin.
What does the word mean?
Look, the word just means a sign. Like, in the narrative context, how is it used? Moshe is going to show Am Yisrael, or show the Egyptians, water will turn to blood. Like, a staff will turn into a snake. So in context, oat is a sign, right? Some kind of miraculous sign, or just a sign per se. Okay, well, good so far?
There is one more mitzvah that's called an oath.
Yeah? Correct. Correct. And Brit Milah. That's correct. Okay. You're right. Although, arguably, oat breed is something different, but you're right. Rabbi Schaffner is correct. Okay, that's the problem with giving shiur with rabbis in the room. Okay. All right, here we go. Okay, so we got the first source down. Okay, now let's go to the Mechilta. Okay, Mechilta is a Midrash Halacha and Sefer Shemot. Okay, and if we have here, there's a clash between Shabbat and Tefillin. In theory, that clash could play out different ways. So how does the clash play out? So it says, Yitzchak Mahov v'Shabbat k'yot etzun k'yot, lo yitein ot betochot, yitein ot betochot, amrata, tidche Shabbat k'yot, ubrit, lit Tefillin sh'en k'yot ubrit. So in this clash, what happens? Why does Shabbat override Tefillin? Okay, it's more. Somehow Shabbat has more halachic weight. It is not only an oath, it is also a brit, where Tefillin, we only have the oath phrase without the brit phrase. So given that clash, it seems to be we're working along we're not taking it one step further. That's why Shabbat has more weight than Tefillin. Give me 2 more seconds, Yakir. Okay, if we go to the Aruch HaShulchan, I'll do this outside. He quotes another line from the Mechilta, which I didn't give you. There's another way to evaluate Shabbat as being more significant. What's the other criteria we could use? Right, exactly. It's a very interesting question. Do punishments, are they a good barometer for how serious something is in halacha? There's a famous Rambam like this. One more tangent here. Actually, there'll be like 8 more, but here's a good one. Okay. Do we have a way of weighing mitzvot? There's a famous Rambam that says when it comes to mitzvot asay, positive commandments, there's no way to weigh mitzvot. If I ask you what's more important, lulav or sukkah, like what barometer do you have to decide what's more important, lulav or sukkah? But the Rambam suggests when it comes to negative commandments, that's not true. Negative commandments, I do have a ranking system. Because what's the advantage when I'm evaluating negative commandments? Punishment. They have punishments, right? Positive commandments don't have punishments. Even if you don't do them, it doesn't say you don't do it, you get punishment. But negative commandments have. So in theory, I could say, I know the Torah's ranking system. You know, death penalty crimes are the most serious, and lashes is less serious, and monetary is less, and no punishment is the least. So maybe when it comes to lotases, I have a means of ranking. But if that's true, I could plug that in here and say, apparently Shabbat is more weighty than Tefillin, right? There's no punishment for not putting on Tefillin. There's a serious punishment for violating Shabbos. Okay, now I know the halakha, give me 1 more second, halakha weighs more. Okay, so we have 2 different reasons now why in the clash, Shabbat would outdo Tefillin, either because the oat plus the breed quality, or because it has a serious punishment. And then finally, we get to a problem though, okay, and I was alluding to this a little bit before. Shabbat is called an oat in Chumash. What is not called an oat in Chumash? Yom Tov. Very good, Yekir. There's no pasuk anywhere that says that Yom Tov is an oat. And clearly the Gemara in Erevin is assuming, well, if Shabbos is an oat, I guess Yom Tov is also, and you're in the same dynamic. Well, it's a question, it's in 30 seconds. So this bothered the Aruch HaShulchan a little bit. If you look at his last line, what does he say? The Yom Tov avigamken kishabbat sheiktibu Shabbaton. Right, the Torah, several places, says you're supposed to make Yom Tov into a Shabbaton. That shows that Yom Tov and Shabbat have a parallelism. So if Shabbat's a note, I can assume Yom Tov's a note, and therefore we don't put on Tefillin on Shabbat and Yom Tov. Okay, now we take questions, but now we have the background. Clearly, when we get to Chol HaMoed, what's going to be the nature of the analysis? What makes Shabbat and Yom Tov, what gives them their oat quality? And does that apply on Chol Moed? Chol Moed is a kind of interesting middle day. It's Chol, it's Moed, it's a schizophrenic day. Does it have oat quality? Okay, now questions. Yakir.
Is it the last line of the Arach HaShulchan, is it alluding to the fact that both, if it's 8 days, first and last are Yom Tov?
The first and last day of Yom Tov have the full Isra Malacha. Right? And those are the days that are called Shabbaton.
8 days could be more than maybe 2 days than 2 days.
Well, again, Yom HaShmini Shabbaton is only on Sukkot. Right? On Pesach, it wouldn't be the 8th day. He's just using an example. He just wants to show you that the Torah calls Yom Tov a Shabbaton. Okay? Mr. Stein?
If he says that Tefillin outweighs Shabbat, then you'd be in the situation where you say, well, it's Saturday, I'll put my spinning on, and I'm not going to keep
Shabbos. I've already got my nose. Yeah, it's a question. Like, if we decide otherwise, like, how would it play out? That is quite a fascinating question. Yes?
We said that because Shabbat is oat breet, it is dochet filin because it's just oat.
Yes. Well, it's oat and breet.
It's oat and breet.
So I mean, the phrase is not oat breet, but it's called an oat and the...
Is that different from
yes,
now, which is oat breet?
I hope you don't find this too pedantic. I would like to argue that being called an oat and a breet is different than being an oat breet. Okay, but we don't have to fight about it now. It's not so crucial. Yeah, Maishi.
I think once you start drawing parallels of like a mitzvah as an oat and like someone else, someplace else, then like you can get like an endless parallel like fill, and I'm sure.
Okay. Okay. Excellent question. Let me just explain what Maishi asked, and I'll give you an answer which is probably not going to satisfy everybody, or I'm not sure it's going to satisfy me. Okay, Maishi is basically asking if we're willing to expand Shabbat to Yom Tov. So how come Shabbat we read more expansively, but when it comes to tefillin, there all of a sudden we go with a narrow reading? Because if one wanted to expand tefillin, what might you say? Tefillin is roughly parallel to, or what was it? Was that it? Yeah, I would come with mezuzah. Why is tefillin roughly parallel to mezuzah? They keep getting juxtaposed in chumash, right? And they both have like similar parshiot inside, right? So, but she's right. Well, here I'm saying it only says oat for Shabbat and tefillin, but when it comes to Shabbat, I take that oat quality to include Yom Tov. When it comes to tefillin, there I argue there's something special, and I read it more narrowly. I would have to argue that we're not going to work it out now, that somehow the Shabbat Yom Tov parallel is stronger than the overlap between tzitzis, between mezuzah and tefillin. Yeah, Ellie.
I mean, maybe conceptually it's a relevant question, but you don't wear mezuzah on your body, so it's not really, it's not a relevant question practically.
All right. Could still be like an interesting chiddush, but you're not chayav mezuzah on Shabbos and Yom Tov.
I guess.
Okay.
But like, practically, how does that play out in any different?
Okay. Yeah, Isaac.
It's not the greatest group, but you also do have the term Shabbat Shalom in terms of.
Right. Right. Correct. 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 No, I'm not saying it's impossible to answer, but it is an intriguing question. Like, one we're a little bit more expansive about it, and one we're a little bit narrow about how do we read it. Yeah, Mashi.
I think even more so, like, bring me laws. As Rabbi Shapiro said, like, yeah. It has an oat in it. So, like, if you like bring me laws like all your life, you're like. The
although,
entire life, so why don't you have an oat your entire life?
Right, so every day you have two
every
oats.
Day you have one oat. And
okay.
Oat.
Although there's something ironic here. I mean, you could go in a totally different direction with this, but it's kind of fascinating that Brit Mila actually does override Shabbat. Right, so in a certain sense, you could say there, in fact, the oat of Brit does displace the oat of Shabbat,
it's
right?
Oat and
Brit, okay.
It's oat and
so again, that's not really the source of the drasha, meaning it's a drasha based on the phrase biyom HaShabbat, biyom HaShmini, right? Biyom HaShmini, right? That Brit Mila overrides Shabbat, but maybe there's some food for thought there, that there is such a thing as they're also somehow two otot are at work with each other. Yeah?
Yeah, where does the idea of
look, that's what, who asked me that before? Look, Ben, it's not obvious why the otot should clash. It's not obvious there should be a clash. I agree.
We're trying to explain. So, in fact, know that Shabbos, on Shabbos, you don't wear tefillin, then we're trying to explain it. The main hug almost. And they're trying to.
Look, sometimes we have an idea first, and then we try to explain it with a drasha, but you still won't explain where the idea comes from. And it wouldn't remove the question, right? But you could say the drasha led to the idea, or the idea led to the drasha. But either way, it's still a good question. Like,
are there other situations where...
Okay, so, Ben Elias, when I asked your question, that was a good question before.
On Shabbat and Pesach, we still have two
oats. Okay, so Ben went to argue. Wait, what have we said so far? Shabbos is an oat, Yom Tov's an oat, and Tefillin's an oat. And therefore, there's a clash between Tefillin and Shabbat, or a clash between Tefillin and Yom Tov. So Ben said to me, why can't we argue there's a clash between Shabbat and Yom Tov? So again, I'm going to say two things. So one I would say is, again, maybe Shabbat and Yom Tov are viewed as really being overlapping things. Right? Just like we say Shabbat's an oat, Yom Tov's an oat, they're kind of almost the same oat on some level, and therefore they don't clash. But so I was thinking, is there any place in our tradition where we have Shabbat and Yom Tov clash? So I can think of one. Okay, this is not a halachic point, it's more a minute point, but it's an interesting point. But only if you're Ashkenazi, not if you're Sephardi. Okay? They don't really clash. It's true that because of the Gzeira Durbanan, they clash. Let me just clarify what Ben just said. We don't blow shofar on Shabbat, Rosh Hashanah. But where does that come from? It's a rabbinic Gzeira, right? Inherently, the deraita din would actually be, we should blow shofar, even though it's Shabbat. By the way, blowing an instrument is not a malacha. Okay, it's all Gzeira Durbanan. Okay, it's not a malacha to blow an instrument on Shabbat. We don't do it, but it's not a malacha. Really, you could blow a shofar on Shabbat, but we don't do it because of Gzeira Durbanan. Yakir.
What about the Gemara in Megillah where it said that if Yom Tov falls out in Shavuos, you would not, and that day is one day, and then Shabbos, you should push off the Chagiyah for the next day. You shouldn't do the Chagiyah on Shabbos.
Oh, that's interesting. I have to think about that example. I have to think about that. But the example I was thinking is actually Kabbalat Shabbat. What is our minhag when Shabbos and Yom Tov interact? So Ashkenazim truncate Kabbalat Shabbat. Remember that? I actually always find it frustrating because it's my favorite field of the week. And they were like, we skip all those good stanzas from Lechad Odi. Right? One minhag is do the first two and the last two. Right? So that in some sense, what's that minhag saying in some sense? That Shabbat and Yom Tov are somehow clashing. And you emphasize Shabbat too much. It's not respectful to Yom Tov. So you're kind of navigating the clash. But again, that's something very different. That's all minhag. It's not a chiyuv. But that's the one case I could think of where there's some sense of Shabbat and Yom Tov at loggerheads with each other. Yeah, Dr. Stabber.
I'm not sure why we have to go to the oath to debate this. The original tradition was actually, it was a state of holiness that you wore the whole day. But because man was not able to be mentally with God all day, so therefore we limited it only to a short period of time.
Okay.
That you got,
correct.
So the thing that makes Shabbos and Yom Tov so
very good. Excellent.
Is you're in a
excellent
state of holiness, so therefore you don't need the tefillin to be in the state of holiness.
Very good. It's about like divine consciousness, as it were. Right. Very good. Great shot. Great shot. Very good. Okay? Very good shot. Okay. See, it's good to have doctors in the audience too, not just rabbis. Okay. So let's move on now. So we have the background. Now we're going to try to figure out what makes Yom Tov an oath. And after we figure out what is the quality that makes it an oath, does that exist on Chol HaMoed? That should be the test case. Okay, so we'll go to the Rashba, right, the famous Spanish Rishon. He was asked this question. So he says, "V'tfilin b'chol shemoed sh'alta ma'adati, ani sever she'ein manichim." Don't put on tefillin Chol HaMoed. Why? "Shigam emot." How do I know they're an oath? "Shahari chol shemoed asur b'chol malacha she'einu malachat haved." What does he want to claim? So there's two claims here if you think about it. Claim one is, what's the criteria that makes something an oath? What makes the holy day an oath? Yisr malacha. That is what makes the holy day an oath, that you don't do work. And then, that's assumption one. Assumption two. And based on that criteria, Chol HaMoed has an Yisr malacha, and therefore should be an oath. Okay, we're good, Tamar? So again, the Rashba has two assumptions. A, malacha is the criteria, and Chol HaMoed meets the criteria. Therefore, you should not be wearing tefillin. Now, how does Chol... Now, here it's very interesting what happens here. I think we have a good example where we experientially think one way, it might not be true halachically. Most of us in the room, certainly myself, I don't have to talk about anybody else, we don't experience Chol HaMoed as a day of Yisr Malacha. But the reality is there isn't Yisr Malacha, it's just that there's some very widespread leniencies, and that's why we don't experience it. Like one leniency is called Davar HaAved. If you're going to lose money, right, you're allowed to work on Chol HaMoed. That's why most from Jews go to work on Chol HaMoed, right? Or if there's a need of the need of the Moed, right, or need of Rabin, right, there's a community need. So because of all those reasons, we're used to the fact that we do all kinds of malacha on Chol HaMoed. But it still remains true, there is a baseline Yisr malacha, it's just we don't experience it so much. There is an Yisr malacha on Chol HaMoed. So at that point, right, it makes sense the Rashba say. Now that's read the Rashba says the next line. Umalacha doraiti b'moed. Dekulutana maitu mikra. What else does he say? It's an Yisr doraita. How does he know that? Well, the Gemara in Chagiga apparently derives it from Sukkim. Usually things you get from Sukkim are deraita. So we have the Rashba down. The criteria is Yisr Malacha, and Chol HaMoed meets the criteria. Yeah?
How do we handle something like writing?
Look, so the truth is, if you're writing for some need of the moment, right, let's say you're going to the store, and you always, I used to have this, I disagree with my wife all the time, and I have to admit she's right. I'll even admit it on tape. Okay, that I used to say, I'll just memorize the six things I need to get from the makolet. And she'd say, no, you're going to forget one of the six. And of course, I'd always be in makolet and could only think of five or six. So she's right. Okay, so there, of course, would not be a question whatsoever. Right? It's for the needs of the moed. So you could write down, eggs, milk, etc., and that would be fine. But yeah, your question would be really true. What if I'm writing something that I could just as easily do right after the Moed. So you could say that I should avoid writing in that scenario. There are cases where it comes up. Yeah.
So in Israel, people have off for all Sukkot.
Yes. No, because it's one of the heteim is needs the moed. So that could be a need of the moed. I mean, I'm enjoying my moed more because we went on a vacation. Yeah, I don't think that's a halachic problem. Look, with Sukkot, it's just tricky in terms of do you then have access to a sukkah while you're vacationing. But per se, the driving there is not an issue. Okay, we're good? Okay, great. Let us now go to another perspective. We go to Tosfot. It's very interesting because Tosfot is going to disagree on both assumptions. Okay, let's see source 5. Yatsu Shabbatav Yom Tov Shein Atzim Klinot. Lo mishum da siri basiyat malacha. What's the claim? The oat quality of a day is in no way a function of the work prohibition. That's not what makes a day an oat. Now, how does he know that, or they know that? It's Tosfot. Shari chol shomoid asur. Sorry, dafil b'chol. That's the wrong phrase. Dafil chol shomoid tishari basiyat malacha ika oat. The pesach dasu b'chilat chametz v'sukah v'chay b'sukah. This is quite fascinating. Tosfot comes to the same conclusion as the Rashba, but for totally different halachic reasoning. According to Tosfot, would you put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed? No. But why is that? It can't be because Isser Malacha is the criteria. What does Tosfot actually assert? Chol HaMoed does not have Isser Malacha. So in terms of the second premise of the Rashba, that's debatable. Right? The Rashba says Chol HaMoed meets the Isser Malacha criteria, and Tosfot thinks it doesn't meet the Isser Malacha criteria. But according to Tosfot, that's irrelevant, because what makes a day an oat was never about Isser Malacha. What makes a day an oat? I would call it the mitzvah hayom. Yeah. What gives Sukkot its Sukkot quality? You eat a sukkah. What gives Pesach its Pesach quality? You avoid chametz. Those are just as true on Chol HaMoed as they are the Yom Tov. Therefore, you don't put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Now, I think there's a very, almost like philosophical debate here, or an experiential debate, I think, if you think about it. What makes a holy day a holy day? So I think it's very interesting. You ask the average kid, people would think, and here I'll sneak in one of my favorite ideas. Yes, the average kid, he would say, of course, it's the mitzvah yom, right? It's the act of life that gives it its status. It's that you go sit in a sukkah. It's that you avoid chametz. That's what gives it day to day. But what if, I think an interesting assumption emerges in the Rashba. What if one could argue experientially that's not true? Actually, the most essential element of a yom kadosh is not doing malacha. Now, I know not doing malacha is not as dramatic, as not as fun as going to the sukkah. I guess avoiding chametz is not so much fun, I suppose. Or as eating matzah. But maybe nonetheless, if we think about it experientially, that's what really gives the day a different feel. I'll give you a good proof. Most of us do not experience Chol HaMoed as a holy day. Actually, I'll do it myself again. I do not experience Chol HaMoed as a holy day. Why not? Because I'm doing malacha all the time, right? I'm driving to the supermarket. I'm turning on the microwave, right? And Rosh Chodesh is another example. Like, having us experience like Rosh Chodesh as a day of any status. Right, I think we tend to not because, okay, Yakir, you do, right?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Okay, but most of us don't. Okay, because there's no Isser Malacha. So maybe there's another interesting debate lying here. Like, ultimately, the old quality of Shabbat Yom, is that a function of Isser Malacha? Or is that a function of Mitzvah Hayom? But either way, all the positions thus far would say, Chol HaMoed meets the criteria, therefore we shouldn't wear Tzvon Chol HaMoed. Roni.
What would be the oat for Shabbat?
Okay, and ask even better, guys, besides Roni's question? Okay, excellent. I was waiting for somebody to ask that. I'm kind of shocked. I haven't yet found an Achron who asked this question. It can't be no Achron who asked this question. It's got to be after somebody who just haven't found it yet. Right? If we focus on Mitzvah Hayom, that's great for Pesach and Sukkot, but I can think of two Chagim that don't really have Mitzvah Hayom. Okay, which are? Shavuot and? Mort? Shemini Atzeret. Right? Which is interesting also theologically. Like, why are the Chagim that don't really have Mitzvot? Why does Shavuos not have a mitzvah? Why does Shemir Tzeret? Mort? Okay, unless it's correct. It could be the answer to all three questions is Kiddush. If we view Kiddush as mitzvah yom, then you would say Shabbat has, and Shavuot Shemir Tzeret has, and Shavuot has. Maybe that would be a way of solving the problem. Yeah.
No, I
love it. Yeah, Moshe.
If you're going to say that, then any holiday with a mitzvah yom, is that going to call that note? So then you shouldn't put tefillin on for any of the other holidays.
Either. Such as?
Such as Rosh Hashanah or like anything with...
But Kiddush. We don't wear tefillin on Rosh Hashanah.
Or like...
Well, Purim actually doesn't have Kiddush. And Purim's the Rabbana.
Those are all considered oats also? Why aren't they like
look, I think for our purposes here, it's interesting. Maisha, you're right. Sometimes we do differentiate between like the Gimel Regalim and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Okay, he's right. For example, actually, let's throw that to the crowd. Okay, this is a very interesting question. Like, you could talk about Yamim Kadoshim. Oh, someone could write a whole book about this. Keep it guessing. This could be your new doctoral thesis. What? Yeah, you know, you'll do a postdoc. It'll take a while. There's always those guys who want to be a student forever, right? Okay. So you could say when you differentiate among the holy days, I think you could draw lines in a lot of interesting places. You could say there's a Pesach Shavuot Sukkot triumvirate. That's one place you could draw the line. Are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur with them, or are they separate from them? So you could draw another line. And then Shabbat could come into play. Is Shabbat part of the club? It's almost like these concentric circles. You got the Gimel Galim, we got Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we've got Shabbat. And when do they like each other? When do they not like each other? So can we give an example? Where are the Gimel Regalim not like Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? Where would you draw a line there? Okay, very good. There's no mitzvah Aliyah L'Regal on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. It's kind of funny because Yom Kippur, in some ways, the Mikdash is the most dramatic thing that's going on, but there's no mitzvah for the average Jew to come to the Mikdash on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, but there would be a mitzvah on Pesach Shavuot and Sukkot. So that's a pretty strong... What? Okay, so that would be a strong dividing line. For example, we say Hallel on Pesach Shavuot and Sukkot. We don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. So Maishi's right. In theory, you could have tried to draw the oat line there, but apparently everybody agrees that for this purpose, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur are with the Gemur Galim and with Shabbat for that matter. Okay. Yeah.
So we discussed the distinction of Mitzvot Hayom versus
Isser Melacha. Yeah.
And the idea that like positive things are less memorable.
Well, that was my take. That was just, right. You don't have to accept that.
I'm not sure it's an entirely applicable parallel unless you phrase it with the mitzvah is matzah instead of the mitzvah is isur chametz.
Correct. Look, I think I could still argue that maybe I overstated the negative positive split, but isur melacha is kind of a pervading atmosphere in a way that maybe even isur chametz is not. Isser Melacha pervades the day in a way that just avoiding leavened bread is not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Okay? Even within Yisurim, I think I can make a distinction.
Depends how much pizza you usually
eat. That's correct. That is correct. Robbie Bernstein. Okay. Guys, I have to publicly apologize to Robbie, guys. After having for Shabbos, I changed my mind. He's not the most picky eater in the Yeshiva. It's totally not true. Okay, I'm going to start picking on somebody else. Okay. All right. So let's move on to some other possibilities. But don't worry, Andrew Levine, you stole the title, don't worry. Okay. On the other side of the divide. Okay. Let us go to one more possibility. Okay, let's go to the Meirin, page 6. Okay. Rabbi Yehuda Mati Yochtov La'atzmo Svarim Tzonu Mezuzot. Now this is, just realize one thing, what is Masechet Moed Katan actually about? It's about Chol HaMoed, right? What is the little holiday? Chol HaMoed. So actually, is a Masechet dedicated to Chol HaMoed, Masechet Moed Katan. So Rabbi Yehuda says, what could a scribe do on Chol HaMoed? He could write himself a pair of tefillin. Okay. V'yesh mi shemolchiach mikan shemanichan tefillin b'chol shemoed. V'enikoy od b'yom tov shemlokin eichat hitura asiatan hutra asiatan moed. What's the claim? So we just said with Danny Reichler's question before. When could you write on Chol HaMoed if it's for relevant usage right now? But I shouldn't write if I don't really need to. So what might be the proof? If we let the scribe write himself a pair of tefillin on Chol HaMoed, apparently he's going to be wearing them. So maybe that's a proof against what we've said so far. Maybe that's a clear proof that you do wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Okay, excellent. And then he says at the end, there are different minhagim already between France and Spain. So he mentioned one other criteria he throws in. What does he throw in? Maybe it's not malacha, maybe it's also about... What else did the Meiri bring up for the first time? Karban Musaf. Maybe she's Musaf as a criteria. Obviously on Chol HaMoed we do bring a Karban Musaf. So that would be another reason. So we already have three different possible ways that Chol HaMoed could be an oat. Chol HaMoed could be an oat because it has some Isser Malacha. Chol HaMoed could be an oat because it has Mitzvot Hayom. Chol HaMoed could be an oat because it has... The Karban Musaf, one second, Roni. What does he say at the end? What does he suggest? Put it on, but don't make a bracha. Right? It's a classic halacha compromise. We're not sure if we should do it or not. You could do the mitzvah with or without a bracha. A bracha might be a bracha of atala. So that's the compromise position. We should put on tefillin Chol HaMoed and not make a bracha. Roni. Okay, good question. Isaac Saltz, want to give your answer? Well, he keep your eyes right. It all is interesting, though. A minhag did develop to take off your tefillin before Musaf on Rosh Chodesh. So you have to plug that in, okay? Why that minhag developed is interesting, but not for us right this second. Natan, you want to ask the same question? Good question, Natan. Okay, here we go. Okay, now, last theory here, guys. Last theory, we're going to move in another direction. Okay, there is a German Rishon, Rav Yitzchak from Vienna, who wrote a sefer called Or Zeruah. Okay, and he has, I admit, guys, I put this in just for a little comic relief in the middle. I freely admit it. Okay, but you know, you have to lighten things up a little bit. So there is an agadic idea, and you have to thank Rav Noam. Okay, there was one phrase here I could not forget what it meant, and Rav Noam found it for me. Okay, yes. No, well, Nahar Sabat, I knew what it meant. The phrase after that, I did not know what it meant. Okay, but there's an agadic idea, if I want to look up, it's Sanhedrin Samachem Abed, where it says there was a river called Sambat Yon, which was very stormy, but every Shabbat it would come to rest, like reflecting the tranquility that Shabbat brings to the world. Okay, so that's the Nahar Sambat Yon, the stormy river that would come to rest on Shabbat. And it's actually very interesting dialogue there. There's kind of like certain type scenes that come up a lot in Midrash and Gemara. One classic one is discussions between like Roman noblemen and Jewish sages. Right? Like there's a guy named Turnus Rufus, who often has conversations with Rabbi Akiva. So take a look at that Gemara, very, very interesting Gemara. Sanhedrin Samachem Abed, what their dialogue is about. Basically, this fellow says to Rabbi Akiva, how do you know it's Shabbos? So Rabbi Akiva says, I can prove it's Shabbos because the Sambat Yom comes to rest. And because something to do with Balat Ov, right? When you try to necromancy, you try to communicate with the dead. So Rikiva says that doesn't work on Shabbos, apparently. Right? The dead don't work on Shabbos. Okay? So see, guys, Shabbos is so great, even the dead get the day off. Okay? So that those are the two ways of knowing that it's Shabbat. Okay? And that is that the phrase Mala B'Zichro has to do with the necromancy. Okay? That's not actually connected to our current topic. So it says the Ur Zeruah. Pretty remarkable. What does Ezra say? What makes Shabbat an oat? The fact that the Sambat Yon is not raging. That's why they know it's an oat. So now we have a very simple solution, guys. We can solve all our halakhic problems. Happily figure out if Chol HaMoed is an oat or not. That's it. It's very simple. So he says in the last line, okay, you'd like that, Ben. So we have a simple solution, except we have no idea where the Sambat Yon River is. But if we could send an explorer to the Sambat Yon River, they would check if it rests on Chol HaMoed, and then we would know if Chol HaMoed is. No, I get it. That's not mainstream halachic analysis, but just what I throw that in. Okay, so we got four possibilities, I suppose. Is the oat quality about malacha, mitzvah hayom, carbon musaf, or the Sambat Yon? Famous four-way debate. Yeah.
So Rav Noam told us an idea about how the lost 10 tribes are across the Sambat.
Yes, there is such an idea.
And the only reason they can't come across.
You wonder why didn't they just travel on Shabbos? Is that your question?
No, is if it rested on Chol HaMoed, wouldn't they be able to travel on Chol HaMoed?
Oh, what a killer proof there. Oh. Rav Noam, you heard that? Is it?
Great.
Okay. Yeah, very good, Ben. Okay. Excellent. Okay, so we're not going to move on. Now, we saw a little bit of a tension here. Ben, put it in your safer, okay? Put in your safer. Okay. We saw a little bit of a tension. If you say the criteria is Isra Malacha, does Chol HaMoed meet the criteria or not? And we can understand that tension, because as I said, there is an Isra Malacha. We have all these built-in leniencies. But maybe that's reflective of a deeper debate. We're going to discover right now there's a debate if the Isra Malacha and Chol HaMoed is an Isra Daraita or an Isra Drabanan. And certainly, if it's Isra Drabanan, there's more weight to say Chol HaMoed would fail to meet the criteria. It doesn't really have an Isra Malacha. If it's an Isra Doraita, it's easier to argue Chol HaMoed would meet the criteria. So without getting, because I'm going to run out of time, just very briefly, I hope you saw that's a machlok in the Or Zeruah and the Tosfot. Or Zeruah says it's an Isra Doraita on Chol HaMoed to do Malacha, and the Tosfot says only Isra Drabanan. So maybe that's really lurking on the question whether Chol HaMoed meets the criteria. I just want to raise one issue, which is quite interesting. What might make one think that the Tosfot is right, that Chol HaMoed is only an Isra Drabanan? He has many arguments, but I think what was the most convincing argument? Why would you say that Isra Malacha and Chol HaMoed is derived from none and not Doraita? Especially as there are psukim that it's derived from. Exactly. Isn't that, Ben's absolutely right. Isn't it true in the halachic system, the more flexibility you see, the more leniencies you see, the more you tend to assume the prohibition in question can't be that serious? We just noticed we have so many leniencies that we barely experience the Isra Malacha and Chol HaMoed. Where do all those leniencies come from? Well, if Chol HaMoed is an Isra Drabanan to begin with, it makes a lot of sense that leniencies are built into the system. Right, that's standard. If it's a right, it's a bit harder to understand. And indeed, there's kind of a pretty interesting idea in Yer Zeruah. It was a little bit hard to read, but remember he says, Lo masrona kutub lidreish al chachamim. There's an idea we've shown him that when it comes to Chol HaMoed, it's almost like the Torah said, we want there to be some status. You rabbis decide how that plays out. Which would mean it's a deraita with built-in rabbinic flexibility. It's kind of a very interesting idea. Right, everyone takes note of all the flexibility on Chol HaMoed. Right? Tosfot concludes, if it's so flexible, it must be the Rabbanan. The Or Zeruah suggests it's kind of this unusual deraita given over to the rabbis to apply judiciously. And therefore, you could still say it's deraita, even though it has all that flexibility. Okay? We're good with that? Okay. Now let's go to the other side. Okay, I'm going to take questions again about 5-10 minutes. Okay. Okay, and the guys were very excited because it's the first time in the history of Oraita that a Zohar is on the Shir Kol sheet. Okay, because parents should realize this does not happen every week. Okay. And I did say to some of the guys, Chavruta, you could skip that if you want, because obviously the Zohar's Aramaic is much harder. But we're going to read through it together. Here we go, source 9. Now, this was a very interesting test case, like what influence should Kabbalistic ideas have on halachic practice? Because notice, if we stop the Shir right here, you could debate it, and you could have both sides justified on purely halachic grounds. Right? You don't need to bring in any mystical ideas. You could give a good argument why you should wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. It's not an oath. It doesn't have a realistic halacha. You could give an argument why you should not wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. That's what we've seen. However, what happens when Kabbalah enters the fray at Zohar, enters the mix? So let's go to the Zohar, okay? I'm going to just explain the words. I don't think I can explain the deeper ideas. If you want a deeper idea, you can go to Rav Dovid afterward or Rav Nagin this afternoon, and maybe you'll find out. Okay? Ravad, you willing to take it on also?
No.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Rav Amnuna Savar, Haki Ilan Einan Yamin Tovim, Dikrin Tovim. What is the Yom Tov? What makes it a Yom Tov? The Inun Tfilin Duresha. The sum association with Yom Tov and Tfilin Sharosh. The Inun Tfilin Dekutcha Brichu Manachot. It is an idea in the Gemara Brachot Avav that God has a pair of Tfilin. Very nice idea, actually, because what does it say in our Tfilin? Our dedication to God. What does it say in God's Tfilin? His dedication to Am Yisrael. Excellent. But what's the claim? Somehow the Tfilin Sharosh of God is associated with Yom Tov. Okay, Ikun Tovim begin the Inu Naran Beresha, the Kuchila, of a Cholata Yom Tov, Inu Tilin Beresha, Kuchim Kumanagon, Cholo Shel Moed, the low Ikri Yom Tov, that's not a Yom Tov, Eilun Tilin Didroa, okay, someone who I did not help. What does Didroa mean? Okay, very good, guys. Remember there's a Dalet Zayin rule? How do you say gold in Aramaic? Dehava, right? So here we have, right, Didroa is Didroa. Okay, Evan, you knew that?
Yeah.
Way to go. Very good, Evan. Okay, so Chol HaMoed is the Tefillin Shel Yad. Again, the Tefillin Shel Yad of, right, the supernal Tefillin Shel Yad. Okay, the let lay, now he's very interesting idea coming up. This is not our topic at all, but it's fascinating food for thought. Let lay le sira migarma klum. It doesn't have illumination, sira, migarma from itself. El minihiru de yom tov. Now this is fascinating. What's he basically saying? It's like a little sun-moon imagery here, right? There are two things that illuminate, but one's the real source of illumination, and one is the reflection. So what, how does that plug in here? Yom Tov is the real source of illumination, and Chol HaMoed is the reflection. But even more interestingly, this is real food for thought. Apparently, that's also true about the relationship between Tefillin Shel Rosh, Tefillin Shel Yad, which is quite fascinating. Right? Tefillin Shel Rosh is the source of light, as it were, and Tefillin Shel Yad would be the reflection. Everyone have the portrait here? What do we have again? Yom Tov is Tefillin Shel Rosh of God. Chol HaMoed is Tefillin Shel Yad of Hashem. Right? Chol HaMoed reflects the light of Yom Tov, and Tefillin Shel Yad reflects the light of the Shel Rosh. So there's a lot of food for thought what that means and how it should impact understanding of Tefillin. I think it's very, very fascinating. Be that as it may, let's go to the last two lines. We'll begin kach, the Eilin Yomin, the Einan Tefillin Demar Yalma, those days when the Tefillin of Hashem are manifest, Asur la'ancha shar tefillin. What's the point now? I mean, if Yom Tov Chol HaMoed reflect divine tefillin, oh, divine tefillin certainly renders human tefillin inoperative, right? And therefore, notice the language here. Not only eino chayav, but asur. So it turns out from a Kabbalistic perspective, it is negative to wear tefillin on Yom Tov, and explicitly also negative to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So now, besides this whole fascinating perspective here, we now should just wait. What's going to happen when this gets added to the halakha conversation? Again, we had a whole halakha conversation, she wrote Tefillin and Chol HaMoed, without bringing in the Zohar. But now, when the Zohar goes public in the 1200s, and posts can read it, is this going to influence their psak? Do Kabbalistic ideas have a role to play in halakhic history? Because then maybe Kabbalah should come along and like close the deal. We just won't wear Tefillin anymore. Now, notice one thing, not so surprising. Who did I say doesn't wear Tefillin and Chol HaMoed? In Chutzlarts? Svardim and Chassidim. Okay, do you think it's an accident? Okay, one might suggest, okay, Mr. Weiss, can I say this? Is it okay? Okay, one might suggest that Svardim and Chassidim are groups that are more prone to Kabbalistic influence than non-Chassidic Ashkenazim. Okay, so maybe it's not happenstance that's what occurred. Just to mention one other thing, though. I mentioned before when I started this year that in Israel, at the Universal Minhag, not to wear tefillin, Israeli Minhagim come from several places. Sometimes it comes from Yosef Karo. Yosef Karo was in Israel. Sometimes it comes actually from the Gra. Right? A number of the Gra's Talmidim made Aliyah in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And therefore, a lot of Minhag Eretz Israel have to do with the influence of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon thought you should not wear Tefillin on Chol HaMoed. So I didn't check this out, but I did read an article somewhere that maybe the reason I became the universal minhag in Israel not to wear tefillin actually stems from the students that only go. Like, that's how it became a very strong minhag here not to. Okay, we're good? Okay, so now let's see how this plays out halakhically. So see three very interesting sources. Okay, so now again, we talk about the Zohar becoming well-known in the 1200s. So now it's not an accident. Three different rabbinic writers in the 1400s and 1500s are now trying to figure out how this plays in. So if we go to the, we'll go a little out of order. We'll go to the Beit Yosef, for this of Kari, source 12. He says, should Kabbalah play a role? He says, well, what's the evidence of the Talmud Bavli? Not clear. What's his basic principle? If we don't have a clear argument answer from the Talmud Bavli, go with the Zohar. Right? So apparently if the Zohar would be against the Gemara, then he would say, no, that's not, we can't go that far. We would follow the Gemara. But as long as the Gemara is ambiguous, let's go with the Zohar. So Yosef Kari says, okay, the Zohar is going to determine the answer, and the answer will be we should not put on tefillin on Chol Moed, which again is the standard Sephardi position. Okay? Excellent. Okay, if we go to the Radvaz, Rabbi David Ibn Zimmer, he's in Egypt in the 1400s. He has something very similar. Oh, just one other thing. I always find it interesting. I wish we could write like that. We don't know Tanakh well enough to write like that. If you're a rabbinic writer with a little bit of a poetic sense, what do? All the time? You're constantly using psukim, but you're not announcing it. Your audience is supposed to get it. Okay? It used to be people knew Tanakh better. To give an example of this for, I think some of you, the parents will agree with me on this one. Okay, a couple years ago, I read Uncle Tom's Cabin for the first time. And I found it fascinating. Like, Harriet Beecher Stowe was quoting psukim left and right, but she never says it. She doesn't say as it says in Isaiah. She just quotes the psukim. And I'm kind of wondering, does that mean like the average American reader in the 1800s got all those biblical references? People did want to know the Bible better. It's kind of interesting. Is that what she's assuming? Okay, Jordan.
I'm surprised you don't have any Rambam on
here. Okay.
What does he
hold? Okay. Jordan, I'll give you some homework. Look it up. Okay. See what the Rambam says. Okay. Always dangerous to ask the question. Okay.
I'm happy to go.
Okay, so let's go back to the Radvaz here. So again, they don't announce the, but again, if you know psukim, they're lurking in the back of your mind. You can use those phrases. Here's a good example. The Radvaz. Sheila and Yeshla niyachtzim b'chol moed. Kiriti b'zek kala'am poschim al shtei hasifim. Okay, my son's ineligible for this. Where's that pasuk from? Oh, somebody get it. Let's go. Okay, Natan. What? Nope. Sam. Excellent. How do you do it? Okay, very good. Okay, it is a famous conflict between, or contest between Elio and the false prophets of Baal at Har Carmel, and the people are kind of hedging their bets. Are we with God? Are we with Baal? So Elio says to them, exactly, Ad matay atem poschim al shtei asifim. So that becomes a phrase for a rabbinic writer when someone's kind of on the fence. That, if you want to say that in rabbinic phraseology, I would say I'm on the fence. Right, poseach or seasifim. Okay, very good. Ravadi, way to go. Okay, not good at Kabbalah, but good at Malachim. Let's say Malachim. Okay, so here we have. So it says here, okay, why the poseach al shtei seasifim? Lefisha Rashda al katab etshuv shechayav laniach. The Rashda says you should put on. The katab gdol mizu shat etshuva mutar lekavah b'chol amayim shem davrei. Umiktzatam, know what, look what happens now, very interesting. Umiktzatam yureim latzmam. Why are some people afraid to put them on? Which is obviously also a phrase, right? We say in davening. Okay, so we're kind of conflicted here. But notice already, Kabbalah is playing a role. And if you skip to the last line, what's his ultimate conclusion? The kivinchi plukta divriya kabbalah yachrichu vata al taniach. Very similar to Beit Yosef. Where's the Ravaz go with it? If it had been clear what the answer is, we would go with the answer. But since already it's debatable, once again, then Kabbalah. So again, we seem to have one position here. When things are ambiguous and debatable, then Kabbalah can come in and determine the answer, and therefore in the Radvaz and in the Beit Yosef, we would ultimately recommend not wearing. Okay, now we go to Poland. I think it's quite similar. Again, when you have a clear halakhic answer, go with that. When you have an ambiguous halakhic answer, then Kabbalah can help you be machriya. Okay? We now go to Poland in the 1500s to Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal, who's a very interesting contemporary of the Ramah. In fact, he had a great debate with Rama. Okay, I can't resist, even I'm running out of time. Okay, the Rama once wrote a tshuva where the Rama quoted Aristotle. So if Shlomo Luria was not as interested in the world of general philosophy, so if Shlomo Luria wrote to the Rama, I have two complaints about your tshuva. One, you shouldn't quote Aristotle in halachic tshuva. And two, you made a bunch of grammatical errors. Like, if you guys, if any grammatical errors, you should feel badly. The Ramah did also. Right? He points at some of his, like, Zachar Nekeva mistakes or Yachar Rabba mistakes in the Ramah's letter. Okay, so the Ramah writes back. I did not make this up. Look it up. Tshuva Ramah, Tshuva Vav, and Tshuva Zayin. The Ramah writes back, A, it's an old debate about Aristotle. It's okay to quote Aristotle. And B, grammar doesn't really matter anyway. Okay, don't take a look, guys. I did not make it up. So I used to say that I followed the Ramah in both those questions. But I have to admit, now that I'm getting older, I'm starting to like grammar more and more. So I'm not sure the Ramah's right about the second one. Okay, but take a look. So the Marshal was also asked a similar question. And the Marshal is going to focus on other Kabbalistic issues in Tefillin. Look what do you have here. Shesha'alto tial minagi yim laniach tefillin shayad v'yeshiva ba'amidah. Should I put my tefillin shayad standing or sitting? This is quite fascinating. I did not know this before I was preparing this year. Apparently a minhag developed. You stand when you're putting tefillin shorosh. But you sit when you put on. In fact, I have to admit, I don't know anybody who does this. But that's the minhag that the Marshal. I'm sorry? Sfardim do that?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. See? Okay, great. I guess I don't daven Sfardim enough. Excellent. Is that universal? All Sfardim do it? Okay. Rafi Wint, you'll do that one day. Okay. Excellent. Okay, so here we go. Now, where did this come from? Dalvi Chadashim Yikarbo. Oh, once again. Rabbinic writer, you just can't resist throwing in a biblical phrase there. Okay? Again, we just said how if you're a rabbi, how do you say you're on the fence? Now we know if you're a rabbi, how do you say a novelty just emerged? Where does that pasuk come from? Chadashim Yikarbo. Ben Eisenstein, Balkori, you got it? Okay, anybody? Chadashim Yikarbo? I'll give you a hint, guys. It's in Chumash, not even in Navi. Okay, Mortz, help us out. Yeah, it's in Hazinu. Okay, Chadashim Yikarbo Lo Shurum Avotam. Okay? What? You never learned Hazinu? Okay, you have an excuse. Okay, so what is this novelty? Who's raising this novelty about the Yad and the Shul Rosh? V'rotzim liot mikat hamekubalim. Interesting, where's this coming from apparently? Kabbalah. That's also, by the way, it would also fit, but it's far made from Kabbalah once again. Right, the Kabbalists want you to do this. Umimidoshei ha-nelamim. Right, that's actually the name of part of the Zohar, right? Midoshei ha-nelam. Umechloshei ha-ra'ud. Look at the phraseology here. Lo yabitu b'or ha-zohar. V'lo yadu motzo mavo. So it's got a little bit of a criticism here. Like, they don't really understand what's going on, but they think they're these great Kabbalists, and therefore, that's where the halachic practice is coming from. Okay, and then he goes on to say, El Shekach Matzu B'Sifri Rashim B'Yochai V'da Ahuvi Shekor B'Tayim B'Tayik Doshim Shemu Goni Olam Re'iti Mem Shelona Gukach. They don't do this. El Kedivri HaTalmud Av HaPoskim. According to the Marshal, where's halacha supposed to come from? Shas, the Rosh, the Riv, the Rambam. That's where halacha is supposed to come from. The Imay Rashim B'Yochai Omid L'Finin U'Vitzavach L'Shenot HaMinhag. If Rashi Bechai would come back to life now and tell us, you do X, but really you should be doing Y, Shenishnago Karmonim, Lo Ashkechinen Bey. We would. Lo Ashkechinen Bey? We're not paying any attention. So the Marshal, it's an interesting debate here. He seems to say, you know what? Kabbalah is a wonderful thing, but is not an influence in the world of halakha. Every area of life has its own mode of thinking, its own mode of working things out. Okay, that halakha is meant to be based on halakhic arguments, not based on Kabbalistic arguments. So you have this very interesting debate beyond everything else here, right? Beyond the question, is Chol Moed an Ode or not, what role could the Zohar have in halacha? Right, again, for both Rav Yosef Karo and Radvaz, as long as halachic sources are kind of ambiguous, go ahead, follow the Zohar. And the Marshal, I mean, he's also about going against the Minhag. The Marshal is more close to the idea that Kabbalah could influence how Pesach should play out. Yeah?
Did the Marshal live before or after the same time as
same time. I mean, again, Radvaz is a bit earlier, late 1400s, and then Rav Yosef Karo and the Ramah and Rav Shlomo Luria are all the 1500s.
So didn't you say, like, we spoke about this a couple weeks ago, that there was, like, a little debate, and that we were saying that Rav Yosef Karo was influenced by Kabbalah?
Correct. Isn't this a good example? What does Rav Yosef Karo say right here?
No.
Since Shas doesn't give a definitive answer.
Correct. So basically, so the Marshal completely disagrees with Rav Yosef Karo that halacha should not be influenced by Kabbalah.
Yeah, just to be fair, again, he's particularly objecting because it's going against what he says is a minhag, but I think he's much less open to Kabbalah playing a role in halacha. Okay? All right, last idea, guys, and we'll wrap up this year. Excellent. Okay, what do we actually do? So go to 13 and 14. Okay, there's a good note to end on. B'chol ha-moed gamkin asur l'anech tefillin metam ezeh ba'atzmo. Shimei chol ha-moed in gamkin mo. Not surprisingly, Rav Yosef Karo Paskins, we don't put on tefillin chol ha-moed. Indeed, that's the Sephardi
Pesach.
Yeah? Very good. What was the phrase? No, Jordan, your distinction is great. You just happen to be misapplying it here. No, Jordan's absolutely right. There's a big difference between not being chayef to and forbidden. And you're right, it's a possible halachic position out there that you just don't have to, but it's not a sure. But there's a lot of implications for this. Just mentioned very briefly, are tefillin muktzah or not? Right, it's also a discussion. If tefillin is just, there's no chiyuv, should tefillin be muktzah?
No.
No, okay, there's no chiyuv to put them on, but I could. If you say it's usher to put on tefillin on Shabbos and Yom Tov, then tefillin have no purpose. Then tefillin and Shabbos should be muktzah. It's actually a lot of implications to your point, Jordan. But what was the language of this regular sukkah, actually? Asur laniach, right?
Okay.
So it sounds like he thinks, no, it's not just you're not chayev, it's problematic. Yes. Excellent. Okay. Just putting it on. Okay, again, because if you're working off, I think Jordan's right, if you work off the Zohar, certainly there's a sense that it's not just not a chayev, it's problematic. Okay. The Yesh, what's the Ramah say? The Yesh, Mim Shechol HaMoed, Chai B'Tfilin. Again, many Ashkenazim do put it on. V'cheinogin B'chol Gvilot Elo. So in Poland, we put it on. La'nichem B'moed L'varech Eliyem. Ella. Now here comes to the last fascinating thing. We saw one compromise before. And that was a classic compromise. What was the classic halachic compromise? Put them on, but don't make a bracha. That we have all the time. Now we're going to have a very unusual halachic compromise. What's the compromise here? Elish Ein M'varechin Eliyem B'chol Ram B'beit HaKnesset. What's the new compromise? Put them on, make a bracha, bud. Softly. Now, this is fascinating, because the old compromise, we understand, what are you trying to accomplish? If I put them on, I fulfill the mitzvah, but if I don't make the bracha, I avoid any question of a bracha levatala, a superfluous bracha. But what is accomplished by the compromise of saying it softly? So the first time I read it, I was thinking, somehow, oh, it's a new shita. You could do bracha levatala softly. Right? If you do them loudly, they're problematic. But if you do them softly, you're okay. Now, that doesn't make very much sense, right? If it's superfluous, it's superfluous. It doesn't matter like what volume you are reaching. So I was curious what the logic of this compromise is. Joe?
I think it's because then that is going to hear you and say amen when it's bracha
levatala. And amen is going to be what?
When it's bracha levatala. Nobody's going to say amen. I read that somewhere.
Really?
Yeah.
Meaning it's okay to make a bracha levatala, just we don't want you to say amen to a bracha levatala?
Like,
no, but there we actually... okay, interesting. Although we deal with it a little differently there, because there's also the Baruch Shem, it's a whole other topic,
yeah.
But it's interesting, probably you just said, Joe. Okay, let's go to the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah is a great shot. So what's this compromise? Why say, but say it softly? Pirish Mishum Diyesh Manichim, Diyesh Enim Nechim. Ah, go to an Ashkenazi shul in Chutz Laaretz. What do you have? Half the people are putting it on. Half are not? Yesh Lavach B'chashai, Kedei Shalo Lavo Bidei Machloket. Ah, that's a good compromise. What is the natural... progression in the Jewish community? If half put on, half don't put on, we fight about it. We fight about who's more pious, who's more devout, right? That's the old minnow, right? That's what we do. So I think this is kind of fascinating, and I think there's a lot of interesting psychological truth to this. The mere fact that people put them on, some do and some don't, we feel like we'll be able to navigate that. But if you want to like prove you're right, what would you do? Say the bracha loudly. That's a good way, like, to irritate the guy next to you and Joel. Right? He doesn't have it on, and you do. You say a bracha very loudly, because how much firmer than you are. I put on... Exactly. So I think it's very interesting. So he says, oh, we've solved that problem. Right? Those that put on, say it softly, and we'll be able to navigate, like, Am Yisrael, we'll have shalom, and we'll be able to enjoy Chol HaMoed. So that is quite an interesting compromise. Okay, anybody have a closing comment or question before I wrap it up here? Yeah?
My rabbi suggested that how you hold that day. So if you're going to work that day, he says you should put it on. If you're not going to work, rather than do that, then you should.
Okay, who's your rabbi?
Gelman.
Oh, that's right. Okay, very interesting. Creative psak, they have Rabbi Gelman. Okay, guys, go to Houston for good psak. Yeah.
I'm just like expanding on that, say, like, there probably are some people who really believe that you can't do malacha on Chol HaMoed because explicit in a direct history. So if that's the case, and they don't do malacha on Yom Tov on Chol HaMoed, then they would definitely just say it's usher to do tefillin as a whole. Whereas you can't.
No, but don't forget, you're first assuming that malacha is the criteria, right? That's one of the debates, right? Is malacha the criteria? And then also, what kind of malacha does Chol HaMoed have? Right? There's several layers of analysis that have to be played in here. Yeah.
Does the Rush give any reasoning for his...
Why does the Rush think you are chayav to put on tefillin?
Yeah.
I think the standard reason would be assuming that malacha is the criteria, and then assuming that Chol HaMoed does not really have... Yes, sir, malacha. Okay, so, yeah, Sam, last comment?
Yeah, back to what Mr. Mishima was saying. Can you connect that with what Sefer HaZeruah, what
his... With the Sabayon?
Yeah. Can you connect that?
I mean, the Sabayon is really a reflection of...
Like, I mean, at the end of the day, you can't really prove whether or not Sabayon is run out of floor or not. As long as you... If you hold by one thing, you shouldn't have a stick like that. It's very subjective.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, just to sum up, I'm not going to do a review because it's a little bit late. Okay, but again, it's very enjoyable learning with all the families. I think it's a good example after you think about halacha seriously, you get good analysis, but it has hashkafic implications, like the things we've discussed. What really makes a yom tov day, essentially? Is it Isra Malacha? Is it Mitzvah Yom? What role could Kabbalah play in halachic sources? Was interesting. And finally, like, how do we navigate different opinions and maintain shalom and shul? So a lot of good values are lurking here in the halachic analysis, and I wish that all the parents should continue to enjoy their stay in yeshiva. Okay, everybody have a great... Oh, remember, Rabbin is giving start meeting here at 2:00 for the deal. Thank you.